let America be America again. It's a poem by Langston Hughes. It's a long reading to begin with, so stay with me. Let America be America again. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great, strong land of love where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme, that any man be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark, and who are you that draws your veil across the stars? Who are you that mumbles in the dark? Who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery's scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker sold to the machine. I am the Negro servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean, hungry yet today, despite the dream, hungry yet today, despite the dream, beaten yet today, oh pioneers, I am the man who never got ahead, the poorest worker bartered through the years, yet I'm the one who dreamt our basic dream. In the old world, while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone, in every furrow turned that's made America the land it had become. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I'm the one who left dark Ireland's shore and Poland's plain and England's grassy lay and tore from black Africa's strand I came to build a homeland for the free. The free. Who said the free? Not me. Surely not me. The millions on relief today. The millions shot down when we strike. The millions who have nothing for our pay. For all the dreams we've dreamed, and all the songs we've sung, and all the hopes we've held, and all the flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for our pay, except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again. The land that never has been yet, and yet must be. The land where every man is free, that land's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose, the steel of freedom does not stain. From those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again, America. Oh yes, America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be. America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain, all the stretch of these great green states, and make America again. On November 8th, 2016, the day that Donald Trump was elected President of the United States, the Oxford English Dictionary released their word of the year. This was the release. After much discussion, debate, and research, the Oxford Dictionary's word of the year, 2016, is post-truth. An adjective defined as relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. So have you become accustomed yet to living in a post-truth era? Oh, good. Stay maladjusted, I heard once. By the time I was reading the Daily News, it was already available for me on an app in my smartphone. But I've heard tell about a time when everyone turned into the 6 o'clock news or opened the front door in the morning to collect the paper in their bathrobe, and whose front page, the paper's front page above the fold, would clue the nation in all at once to the most important news of the day. There was a time, I understand, when the society, by and large, trusted a paper of record, and there were a few reputable anchors who were beloved by all. Do I have that image right? Some of you lived through this time. Yeah. It was a long time coming, the post-truth era. You know, as the myth of the Enlightenment, what one of my teachers would have called the Enlightenment, the myth of perpetual progress, onward and upward forever, as that myth crashed into the story of the 20th century of two world wars and the most calculated efforts of human genocide that humanity has ever seen, modernism's meta-narrative, this grand story we've been telling ourselves, was broken. Scholars who would become to be named postmodernists, they deconstructed all attempts to claim objectivity to tell a single unifying story, a meta-narrative. And here we've arrived. You know, the title for the service today comes from a book by Salman Rushdie. It's Harun and the Sea of Stories. The image just stuck in my imagination since I first read it as a teenager. It's a beautifully evocative story about a boy and his father who are from a sad city, saddest of cities. A city so ruinously sad, he writes, it had forgotten its name. And it sits by a mournful sea full of glum fish, which were so miserable to eat that they made people belch with melancholy. I feel like there's been a lot of belching with melancholy every time I listen to the news. They travel to a fantastical moon in the story that's made of a massive ocean composed of an infinite number of stories, each story taking the form of a current or a stream of a unique color. And the colors, they encompass the whole visible spectrum and extend beyond into spectra that are not known to exist. eventually Harun and his father must confront and stomp the villain Hatamshud, the foe of speech, who is attempting to plug the spring that feeds the sea of stories. And along that way, they find the name of their city, Kahani, which means story. And finding that name lifts the sadness of their people. That image, that sea of stories, so playfully wild in my inner landscape, has taken on another meaning to me now. As I read the news, as I listen to interviews with all those of all political persuasions, I feel adrift in a frighteningly wild sea of stories. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. A stormy and dangerous sea of stories where the idea of story itself seems to have been weaponized. Fake news and alternative facts, Facebook feeds intermingling snippets of friends' lives with sophisticated and targeted political propaganda designed to agitate emotion and undermine our ability to connect with one another. Even without the nefarious content, the vast numbers of people getting their news solely from their Facebook feeds are manipulated simply by the bubbles that our social media creates. The Wall Street Journal at one point produced a web page demonstrating the phenomenon, showing side by side blue and red Facebook feeds. And the stakes in this stormy sea of stories are very high, because some stories lead to a man packing bombs in packages to send to those he believes are ruining our country. Because some stories lead to a man in Kentucky attempting to commit mass murder in a black church, and when the doors were locked, shoot the first black people he saw in a grocery store down the street. Because some stories lead to a man in Pittsburgh opening fire in a worship service to kill Jewish people who he seems to believe are responsible for vast suffering and oppression. And there is a story at the heart of these stories, a meta-narrative that I believe is at the heart of our political crisis, the story of race in America. This is the story that Trump has expertly exploited. It's the story that bleeds like an open wound through all of our political discourse. You know, I think what's so terrifying about our political moment right now is that this chasm of division in our culture, as it deepens and widens before our eyes, we can't even see the beginnings yet of the bridges that must be built. Valerie Carr put it more beautifully. This is her Sikh prayer for America. "The future is dark," she says. "But my faith dares me to ask, what if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if our America is not dead, but a country still waiting to be born? What if the story of America is one long labor? What if all the mothers who came before us, who survived genocide and occupation, slavery and Jim Crow, racism and xenophobia and Islamophobia, political oppression and sexual assault, what if they are standing behind us now, whispering in our ear, 'You're brave'? What if this is our great contraction before we birth a new future? Remember the wisdom of the midwife," she tells us. "Breathe," she says. "Then push. Breathe, then push." When I visited Joan Nelson a couple weeks ago, after talking for a while, me having a chance to take in this incredible force of nature of a woman, this powerful elder and now ancestor in this community. After she had scolded me for taking time with her when I needed to be getting out and making sure we got the next generation involved here in this congregation, after all. Finally, she took me back to her bedroom and showed me a painting. Earth tones coming from the edges to the center, an opening in the shape of an eye in the center, a vision of people dancing, connected around a tree on an open hill before an open sky. She told me in that sort of a trickster lilt that she has, she'd been using the painting as a bit of a Rorschach and asked me what I saw in it. So I told her I saw an eye and a vision, but what struck me even deeper was the sense of a womb, of a new world being born. And that was good enough, I guess, because she proceeded to give me permission to continue to be your minister. Really, she offered me her blessing. I'm grateful for it. The womb. Birthing a new future. Breathe. Push. In the celebrated words of Arundhati Roy, another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day. On a quiet day. I can hear her breathing. But folks, we've got some work to do. If this new world's going to make it. Especially those of us who are white. We've got some work to do. Because we have been trained from an early age to be blind to the racism that is at the heart of our necessary transformation. The racism that permeates our culture, that privileges the color of our skin, trained from an early age to see ourselves as good, as pure, as innocent. And these stories are so deeply ingrained in us that when we do wake up and see the racism that surrounds, we often unconsciously participate in, we find ourselves feeling helpless or defensive or ashamed. All understandable reactions, but all getting in the way of the work of healing that we are called, that we must be part of. You know, one of the things that whiteness relies on is that it remains invisible, that it remains the norm, the baseline. White folks, we don't have to talk about race if we don't want to. What I've heard from many people of color, or better put, people of the global majority, is that they wish that white folks would get more comfortable talking about race, to help educate each other about it so that they're not always in that role. And that's what Robin DiAngelo has done in her book, White Fragility, that's become a New York Times bestseller. It's the common read that our adult religious education team picked. We'll be having a conversation about it after the service today. Hope you might stay for that, even if you haven't a chance. Even if you haven't had a chance to read the book, feel free to stay. So DiAngelo makes it clear we need new stories about race for all of us. Because white privilege, while it does provide material advantage, increased access to safety and comfort, it does so at a cost. The cost in vicious harm and vivid horror that is borne by the global majority, that is borne by people of color, is reflected in the cost to white folks' integrity, to our moral and spiritual wholeness. We've all got to be in it together. James Baldwin, one of the great essayists of the 20th century, named this in The Price of the Ticket. Near the end of the essay by that name, he instructs, "Go back to where you started, or back as far as you can. Examine it all, travel your road again and tell the truth about it. Sing or shout or testify or keep it yourself, but know whence you came." Baldwin's idea is that the construction of whiteness relies is on a cultural amnesia, a forgetting of traditional practices and erasure of culture. Wave after wave of immigrant had to become white. Later in the midnight hour, he writes, the missing identity aches. Later in the midnight hour, the missing identity aches. The price the white American paid for his ticket was to become white. This incredibly limited, not to say dim-witted, ambition has choked many a human being to death here. So I want to have a little taste of that conversation about white fragility now. In a moment, I'm going to invite you to talk with your neighbor about one of your early memories of race. Do you remember the first time that you became aware that race existed? One of mine's from second grade, which is very late. I mean, most people of color in this country can't remember a time when they weren't aware of race. When I remember seeing every day the darkest skinned boy in my class, my second grade class, getting in trouble every day. And the whole class became aware that there was something to do with the darkness of his skin and the need to discipline him. And our teacher wasn't a racist, but he was racist. Like I'm racist, like I believe we are all in this culture that inundates us, that inculcates it in us. And he taught us that. He didn't invent it. The history here goes hundreds of years back. And yet we must all now take responsibility. So, if you will you turn to a neighbor and just share one memory that comes to mind, and early, it doesn't have to be the first one, just one memory that comes to mind of learning about race, that it existed. How'd you learn? Would you be willing to try that risk with me here? Thank you. keep talking about this after the service. Stick around. Thank you. Thanks for risking that. I remember a classmate in seminary talking about a dream she had once. She was sharing a dream, and in the dream, she was holding a baby. And she was going around asking everyone, whose baby is this? She was coming around to everyone she could find in her dream, whose baby is this? Whose baby is this? And somehow she knew that the baby belonged to everyone who she asked. And yet they all denied it. They all denied recognizing this baby. Whose baby is this? And for her, the baby was racism. Somewhat jarring image, but profound to consider. A great societal evil in the image of an unwanted baby. No one willing to claim it as their own. In a world where almost every month we anxiously await news of whether another country will embrace nationalist, xenophobic leaders, it's easy to point to the racism in others. That baby belongs to the South. Let them deal with it. It belongs to the anti-Semites. It belongs to those white nationalists at Charlottesville last year chanting, "Jew will not replace me," an allusion to the racist theory that Jews are conspiring to usher in immigrants of color to replace the white working class. This sea of stories. Well, surely it's their baby. Or it belongs to the militiamen on the border, or the pipe bomber, or the Kentucky shooter. While strident, overt racism gains ground, we can feel helpless. What can we do here in liberal Marin to combat the nationalism and xenophobia, the rampant racism in our world? You know, the explicit curriculum that I learned about race growing up, different from the implicit curriculum of that boy getting in trouble every day. The explicit curriculum I learned was that racism was a profound horror of history. But that basically it was in the past. The worst parts anyway. Becoming aware that racism still exists and that I participate in it, that it is my baby, that was a gradual process. A couple of moments that stick out to share with you. I was working on a project for a college class in black feminism. And me and another white student were putting together, I'm not sure a panel on what, but we were talking with the teacher, another adult advisor, about putting this together and recruiting which students to recruit from the class. And we both came to the same idea, the same student that we'd recruit. We said, it's because she's so articulate, this black woman in the class. And the advisor, I'm so grateful, interrupted us right then and said, "You know, when you say that, you are playing into a huge history. You are actually demeaning her ability to speak her own mind and speak her thoughts by calling her articulate, because you wouldn't call the same white student articulate. You'd take it for granted that they'd be able to express themselves." I'm really grateful that she told me that, and I'm grateful for whatever Unitarian Universalist values have been instilled in me, that I was able to receive it and take it in that moment. But it keeps happening. Several years later, just a few years ago, I was working as a chaplain, and a woman on my unit, I was serving in an inpatient mental health unit, there was a black woman, African-American woman on my unit, who I was providing spiritual care to, and when I went to go reflect on the visit that I'd had with her, with my classmates, my cohort of other chaplains, I realized, putting together the chart note I had written and the verbatim I had written up about the conversation, that I thought that she was somebody else. I had gotten her mixed up with another patient who I had seen the week before. Now, in our white fragility, in our culture of whiteness, it's easy to say, well, yeah, that happens. We mix people up. I mix people up of all races. And there was somebody else, another chaplain, a black chaplain on the team, who had mixed up a couple of white patients. And she had joked about, oh, now I have to confess, I mix you all up too. But the consequences of us white folks doing that, especially in a medical system, and thank God I was a chaplain and not the doctor, the consequences are much greater because the power that the society places is in our hands. I'm still learning. You know, those both are examples of what have become known as microaggressions. They're not the atrocities that have been committed out of the story of white supremacy, but they serve as a near constant reminder to those impacted by them that the dominant culture is built on a story that holds them in truth. We can do better. And we are doing better. I know many of you lent your voices to the effort to rename the Dixie School District here at Santa Fe. We're going to host the renaming party here in December. A small, symbolic step. One breath. One push. It is our baby too. There will be stories told about these times. America will be not great again, but America again, an America that never has been. And that America, that multicultural mosaic, it will tell stories of these times. May we join our lives to that deep wellspring in this stormy sea and tell new stories, wise stories, holy stories. Breathe. Love thy neighbor. Push. Welcome the stranger. Breathe. Seek truth with humility. Push.